From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. If you find money running tight, how much are you going to give away? That's a question facing charities around the nation and the world. With people losing their homes, their jobs, or simply their sense of security, are Americans ready to open their wallets to give? Joining me now is George Rutolo. He's chair of the Giving Institute, an organization that supports philanthropic endeavors. Welcome to News and Notes.
Hi there.
So far, what kind of ripple effect are you seeing on nonprofits and charities?
Well, I think there's obviously a psychological impact that we're all dealing with in watching our money disappear, and I think that's affecting it. Statistically, all we can talk about is what happened in 2007. And it was actually a pretty good year from a philanthropic standpoint. And that was caused by the fact that the first two quarters of 2007 was strong, and it made up for a lackluster performance in the last two quarters. Giving rose at about 3.9% in 2007. And it rose across the board in all sectors.
In tough times, can you make any generalizations about what's happened in the past? What do people support during tough times, and what do people choose not to support?
Since 1967, there have been six recessions, ranging in duration from 8 years to 16 years. What we find is the longer the recession goes on, the more it impacts philanthropy. But the amount of change overall in 40 years during recessionary period is only down 1% when you adjust it for inflation. So it really isn't awful news. The loss of philanthropy during those three recessions that were longer than 8 months, and they were in 69, in 73, and in 81, during those periods of time, philanthropy dropped off about 3 to 4%. So it dropped off more significantly when the recessions went on for a longer period.
What about domestic versus international? You know, there's been a lot of focus on really dealing with the needs of people in other nations. You've even heard during the presidential campaign candidates say what they want to do in terms of reaching out to the world community, but there are limited amounts of wealth, you know, and do you know anything about whether or not?
Absolutely. Yeah, the way we analyze giving in this country is we have a number of different subsectors, and I'll name a few of them. One is religion, the other one is health, social service, human services, and Jeremy might be glad to hear this, but actually, in the area of human services, for one, and another one is international affairs. Giving actually did better than the other subsectors during this period of time. It's one of the factors with international giving is would be disasters, and certainly human services. The need is more prevalent when you have a recession, and I think people might direct their philanthropy. People, corporations, foundations might be directing their philanthropy more towards what they see as a real serious systemic need in the society at that point. You know, we like to talk about the need versus the want. And when you think about the arts and in some cases even education, those are wants as opposed to feeding people and allowing people a place to live and for people who are homeless. So I think people become more focused on the actual need during these recessionary periods.
Well, it's a perfect time to bring in Jeremy Schlittenhart, Community Relations Specialist with Goodwill Southern California. How you doing?
Good. Thank you for having me.
So you guys are known for a couple of things by most people. One is running these stores where everybody goes to get fashion and housewares and things like that. Another one is doing direct service to people with the money that you get from donations and from the proceeds of running the stores. How does that picture fit together in a time of need like now?
Well, I think with the economy the way it is now, people are kind of turning their eye towards Goodwill and retailers such as us and saying, you know, how can I get more bang for my buck? How can I stretch my dollar? Their perception's changing. They're coming into our stores. They're shopping. They're saying, wow, I didn't realize, you know, the stuff I could find here.
Is the majority of the money that supports Goodwill's programs coming from the stores, or is it just a small part?
It's majority of it is coming from the stores. And Charity Navigator, I don't know if George has heard of this, but
yeah,
Charity Navigator.
I've heard of it.
They rated us 4 stars for our 7th straight year. And they also, you know, the general public will be happy to know, we're really promoting this, is the fact that 93 cents of every dollar donated goes to our programs and services that support job training and workforce development. You know, oftentimes you'll see nonprofits in the 80 to 85 percentile range. That's really good, but we're at 93%. So people know, I think, the understanding, you know, of what we do, the job, you know, the job development, workforce development like that.
Give me a concrete example of a program, you know, because when you hear job development, it can mean a lot of things. But if someone walks in, you know, to get some training, what specifically might they do?
Resume building, one-on-one career counseling. Different job industries. These are all things that the general public might not know Goodwill does, but when they go to our stores and they make a purchase, that money will go back into our programs and services.
How much do you think, George, that people pay attention to things like charity ratings? I mean, you know, a lot of people give because someone asks them. You know, someone is walking around in the office and has an organization that they support, and you're like, well, I like Harry, so I'm going to give money to Harry's group. How much do people actually take a strategic look at where they're giving?
I think that it's we're in a situation right now where people are going to continue to support the charities that they've been supporting historically, and it's really incumbent upon those organizations, those charities, to make sure that they communicate exactly what Jeremy was talking about, that they communicate how effective they are in raising money and spending those dollars exactly where the person or the donor determined it should go. So I think that's kind of a standard right now for our business. People who are very serious about philanthropy and give away large sums of money, either as an individual or through a foundation, will go back and track how those funds were used and how effective that generosity was to the ultimate need. So to answer your question, there are a number of different websites out there that people can visit that will really talk about the effectiveness of the organization, and I think it's becoming more and more prevalent.
Jeremy, what about strategies? Do you change your strategy at all to try to make sure that you can do what you need to do during this period? And recognizing that your model is somewhat different from a lot of organizations where you are on a model of selling products, you know, getting donations of products and then reselling them more so than reaching out and, say, mailing out donation forms.
Right. I think our model pretty much stays the same. I think what you find is people can't control gas prices, rising food costs, but what they can control is how they become smarter and savvier in how they shop. And I think we're seeing that more at our Goodwill retail stores. Again, our model will stay the same, but we see more foot traffic, you know, in times like these.
George.
Yes.
Strategy. What do groups do at
a
time like this?
You know, as you were talking about Giving Institute, really what we are is an association of firms that only work with nonprofits, only work with philanthropy, and advise them how to advance their mission. So what we talk about is that during this time, during a slowdown or a recession, it really is incumbent upon the nonprofit to communicate more effectively with the donor and to make the donor feel like they're very, very important, to explain to the donor that, in fact, the needs that they had last year when the economy might have been a bit stronger still exist, and how important their generosity and their philanthropy is. We even recommend that you thank donors for no reason. Donors that have given to you in the past, you just call up and you say, we just want you to know how important your support has been, and this is what we've been able to do with your donations. So the communication has to be ramped up during recessionary times. And the donor has to, again, getting back to the point that you raised earlier, the donor has to be very clear that most of their generosity is going to the cause.
George, I have one final question for you,
sure.
Slightly different in nature. Mm-hmm. A lot of people have been emptying their pockets for the presidential campaign or for local and statewide races because, you know, they feel so passionately about this election. And we've seen these record numbers of people giving. Has that changed the amount of money that's available to go to charities and nonprofits?
What we found is that it really doesn't have any effect because people have a mindset towards charity that is different and distinct than their mindset towards towards politics in terms of the way they invest or give money. We did some additional statistics real quickly that it showed both the year of an election, so this goes back to 1968, the year of an election and the year after an election, that philanthropy grew at a greater rate than it did normally over the course of that 40-year period. Now, we don't have any economic information as to why that happened, but so much of charity and so much of philanthropy is how people feel about themselves, and there might be an uplifting of people's spirits after an election. There's a certain amount of hope that comes with a new presidency.
Well, George and Jeremy, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
George Rutolo is the chair of the Giving Institute, an organization that supports philanthropic endeavors, and he joined us from NPR Studios in New York. And Jeremy Schlittenhart is a community relations specialist with Goodwill Southern California. He joined me in our NPR West studios. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. On August 3, 1908, Colonel Allen Allensworth filed the site plan to start a town in California's San Joaquin Valley. He was born a slave in 1842 in Louisville, Kentucky, and went on to serve in the military. He eventually moved to California, where he purchased 800 acres in Tulare County along the Santa Fe Rail Line. The town of Allensworth became the first in California to be founded and funded solely by African Americans. At its height, it had a bustling economy with a schoolhouse, a church, and a library. Allensworth is celebrating its 100th anniversary, and for some perspective, we turn to Lonnie Bunch. He's the founding director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture. Lonnie, great to have you back on the show.
My pleasure.
So, Allensworth, founded 100 years ago in California's Central Valley. Describe what it was like to be a black person in that area at that historical moment.
Well, imagine, if you will, it's the time in America when segregation is the law of the land, when discrimination against African Americans was the norm rather than being unusual. It was a time when 100 black men per year were lynched in the South. It was a time when most blacks lived in the South and were stuck in low-level jobs, sharecroppers, porters, maids. It was a time when it was hard for people, especially African Americans, to believe that there would be a better day, and yet they did. And Allensworth was really an example of how a community came together to believe, but also to work hard to find a better day.
So who was the man after whom this town is named?
Allensworth, great name, one of the most interesting figures in history. This is a guy who was born as a slave in Kentucky, ultimately, after two tries, escapes, becomes a freeman, and joins the United States Navy because he wants to participate in the Civil War. After serving in the Navy in the Civil War, he basically has a religious conversion, becomes a minister around Knoxville and Nashville, Tennessee, and then he stumbles upon a soldier who says to him, you know, we need black chaplains in the military. In those days, there were four units, the 9th and 10th Cavalry, the 24th, 25th Infantry. He applied to be the chaplain of the 24th Infantry. He was there for 20 years, retired as lieutenant colonel, came to California because he had been there many times with his troop, and was stunned by the discrimination he faced in Southern California and decided, along with four other men, that they would create a colony somewhere in California where, quote, the Negro could be free of prejudice.
So Allensworth was meant to be a haven from discrimination, and it wasn't the only town of its type.
Well, what happens is that there have been a history of African-American towns in Massachusetts, in New Jersey, Boley, Oklahoma, Nicodemus, Kansas. And so Allensworth, on the surface, is just like that, an attempt to create an oasis free of racism. But what I think is so exciting about Allensworth as a community is that they recognize that what they were doing was greater than them. While they definitely wanted to have a community where there could be black businessmen and shopkeepers and school teachers, they recognized that their mission was bigger. If they could be a successful community and show economic progress and show leadership, they felt that would be a beacon of change that would echo around the country, that people would see Allensworth and say, African Americans can control their own destiny, can be contributing members of American society, and their hope would be that would help to change the racial dynamics in this country.
Of course, you move on and troubled times hit. The colonel died in 1914 in a motorcycle accident, and that was just the start of a series of problems that really changed Allensworth. What happened?
Allensworth, as a community, was really in an area where water was key. And when the land was acquired, they were promised that there would always be pumps and there'd always be the kind of level of water they needed. And that failed. And once the water started to go, that called into question their ability to farm. They also made a business of being a depot station where the farmers from the local area would come to put their crops because the Santa Fe Railroad train would go through there. But the farmers complained that they had to deal with these black people, and ultimately a spur was created to bypass, for the railroad to bypass Allensworth. That took some of the business away. And then the notion was Allensworth thought that maybe we could create a Tuskegee of the West, a school like Tuskegee Institute in Alabama, a vocational school for blacks, that could be in Allensworth, and that would provide both an economic engine for the community, but also a real practical purpose for this community. That failed. And then when the colonel is killed in run down by a motorcycle in 1914, suddenly the community doesn't have the bearings it once had.
Let's listen to a little bit from one of the one-time residents, Ed Pope. He recently died, but here he is talking to filmmaker Pam Harris about the time right before World War II.
We left Allensworth. That was in 1940. A lot of people were still here, and they just hung on. But when the war started, and from 41 started, and jobs started to open up in the different cities, that's when everyone left. That was the last great days of Allensworth.
You can hear in his voice this heartbreak. What lessons are we meant to learn from the life cycle of Allensworth, which is by some people called the town that wouldn't die? I mean, it's now still exists as a state historic park, but it's not what it was.
I think that in some ways, there's a lot to learn from Allensworth. First of all, Allensworth was a place that helped people believe, helped people find some positive thing to hold on to when the rest of the world told them there was no possibility there. And many of the people who came out of Allensworth, as you heard in Ed Pope's voice, there was a sense of community, a sense of engagement, a sense of helping each other, but also a sense that this was, in some ways, a special moment where the possibilities that were once there were now gone. And so I think one of the powers of understanding Allensworth is that this is really a proactive attempt by an African-American community not to simply disassociate itself from America, but to be a kind of beacon of hope, a beacon of possibility. And some ways its greatest impact is that the people that once lived there became people who believed in education, believed in change, believed that they could make America better.
Lonnie, thank you so much.
It's my great pleasure.
Lonnie Bunch is the founding director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture. He joined us from the NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. To see an excerpt from the film Land of Promise, the story of Allensworth, go to our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. Now for more on Allensworth, we turn to one-time resident Mrs. Alice Royal. She's the author of Allensworth, The Freedom Colony, a California African-American Township. Mrs. Royal, it's a delight to have you on the show.
It is good to be here.
So you were born in Allensworth in 1923 in your grandparents'
home. Correct.
In your grandparents' home?
Exactly. Mr. and Mrs. Alice and James Hackett.
What are some of the things you remember from being a little girl and going around their house?
Well, I remember my grandmother because I used to follow her everywhere. In the home, in her garden, and she raised all of her vegetables and her condiments for cooking. And then across the road, she had her cows and her chickens. I tried to help her collect the eggs because the chickens knew her better than they knew me. So I just had to watch and cautiously try to reach the eggs every day.
Or else you'd get a peck on the hand.
They were Rhode Island red chickens, and of course the eggs were brown and were supposed to be the most nourishing. And then with the cow, I also tried to milk the cow, but I didn't do a very good job as an 8-year-old. And so most of the time I just watched and helped my mother and my grandmother with the milk and the cream and the churning in the home.
What do you remember about the other people in the town? Did people congregate?
They were very loving, gracious people because my grandparents were highly respected in the community. And then so many of the community members were friends. Some of them were church members, and some of them were educators. Some of them were business people. And we were welcome when we went to the post office. We were welcome when we went to the drugstore. We were welcome when we went to the other stores in the community. And, of course, my aunt was a teacher in the school during my day. And so on special occasions, we had taffy pulls in the Hackett home for all the children in the community. And, of course, that was a joy time as well.
Do you feel that the community was protected, at least at first, from some of the tensions that were going on around race in other parts of the country?
Very true. And so I never knew of any struggles or any of the kinds of things that went on in many city times of the age. There was no policemen. Everything was quiet and peaceful and well run.
How did you feel when Allensworth started to change because of the railroad issue and then ultimately in the 1970s becoming a state historic park? How did it make you feel that this town, which you describe as being so very vibrant, it lives on, but not in the form that it used to?
This is very true. One of the things that even after leaving Allensworth, members of my family were in and out of Allensworth up through the Depression years and up through the years where Allensworth was struggling. But there was always a gathering of the few pioneers, usually during May. Wherever they were, they wanted to come back to Allensworth and have a big picnic and a sharing of pioneer experiences.
How does it make you feel that this anniversary is being celebrated, this centennial?
I'm blessed. I am blessed to carry on what I call a vibrant community, a community of former ex-slaves, former freed people that always had an upward vision. I call the Allensworth pioneers VIA people, people with vision, the intellect, and the ability to carry out their dream of an upward movement, to be freed people with their skills, with their abilities, with their education in a segregated world.
Well, Mrs. Royal, really appreciate this. Thank you.
And thank you.
That was Mrs. Alice Royal. She's a one-time resident of Allensworth and author of Allensworth, The Freedom Colony, a California African-American Township. She joined me from the studios of KVPR in Fresno, California. And finally, we've got a gentleman with a completely different perspective on embracing Allensworth's history. Thomas Ward is a bike ride coordinator for the Colonel Allensworth Century and Fun Ride and owner of Crankin' Time Cycling. Thomas, thanks for coming in the studio.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
So tell us about this bike ride that you helped organize.
Yes, I am working with the Friends of Allensworth, a nonprofit organization dedicated to helping expose people to Colonel Allensworth State Park. And I decided to do it along the lines of promoting with a bike ride, having a central event for people to ride and also learn about the park.
How'd you learn about it?
I learned about the park as a musician. I was playing there and I had to leave and I wanted to stay and I couldn't stay and I decided to come back on my own. And when I did, I decided I wanted to promote it for other people to see as well.
So when you organize a ride like this that raises money for Allensworth, what are you really raising money to do? What do you want to see happen with the town?
Well, they have a nonprofit organization through California State Parks, but they also have a subdivision, which is the Friends of Allensworth, and those people are the ones that actually provide tourists with people dressed in period clothing. I guess they call them docents. And I'm inspired to try to help the docents. You know, a lot of them come from miles around and they spend their own money to, you know, give people like me a tour. And I would like to give some money to them.
You guys have set up a, you know, a very comprehensive event with three different rides for people of different abilities. You know, one is a beginner, no hills, and then you go on from there. Tell me, describe the hardcore ride to me, the one that the tough cyclist will do.
The hardcore hill is called the Granite Wall. That's a 100-mile ride, a little over 100 miles. It's a little over 3,000 feet total climbing.
Why does it make you excited to do this kind of work?
I feel very strongly about letting our people, African Americans, know about a history that they can walk into and take a look at and see for themselves what was done, you know, years ago. In this case, you know, 100 years ago. These were people that had different obstacles to deal with in their time, and they were still able to band together, organize both financially and with labor, and build a town. And it, when you walk there and you see that, it just puts a chill over you that these people said, we have class, we have desires, we want to raise our children safely, we want to educate ourselves, and this is what we tried to do.
Thomas, thank you.
You're welcome.
That was Thomas Ward, the bike ride coordinator for the second annual Allensworth Century and Fun Ride Centennial Celebration. That took place this weekend, and he joined us in our studios here at NPR West. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. From T-shirts to line dances, could black folks' pride in Senator Barack Obama put his White House bid in peril? Plus, Tyler Perry makes history and enemies with the opening of a new studio. And what do Halle Berry and Eminem have in common? We've assembled some pop culture pundits for a special edition of our Bloggers Roundtable. Joining in the conversation today, we've got Danielle Belton of the blog Black Snob and Corey Richardson of Vexed in the City. Hi, folks.
Hello, Farai.
Hey.
So Election Day is just 3 weeks away, so we begin with this. Are black folks going too far in their support of Barack Obama? Now, a middle school teacher in Missouri was suspended after posting a clip called Obama Youth, Junior Fraternity Regiment on YouTube. There was a group of male students in gold boots and army fatigues doing a step routine, kind of like, you know, the black fraternities, and reciting parts of Obama's campaign platform. And don't leave out the older set. They are getting in on the Obama love, too. A group in Detroit, Michigan called Seniors United posted their own YouTube clip of a line dance they call the Obama Hustle. Here is part of the video.
We have something real hot and special for all seniors to learn. We have a hustle for Obama. It's called Seniors Moving for Obama. When Obama wins, we are going to be doing this hustle. So come on, join us. Let's do it. Here we go.
Okay. 500,000 views on YouTube. Danielle.
Yes.
Are black people tripping?
To a certain extent, you know, yes. I mean, but who's really surprised here? I mean, when Barack Obama kind of crossed over from political sensation to the point of, like, icon rather quickly with African Americans, I want to say, like, the minute he won Iowa, you know, it went from being, oh, what an interesting guy. It's really nice he's running for president. You know, I don't really know that much about him, to, oh, my goodness, you know, he's the next Martin Luther King. So it's not surprising that people are kind of getting a little over the top with it, because I think it's just, they're just so proud. It's never happened before. They don't really have anything, there's no hallmarks to really draw on, you know, there's no watermarks to determine what's appropriate, what's not. It's not so much different from, you know, people at Sarah Palin rallies, you know, chanting drill baby drill and, like, wanting to dress like her and, like, selling out of her eyeglasses because they all want frames exactly like her frames. So sometimes the line between celebrity and politician can really get blurred really fast.
All right, Corey, what do you think?
Well, yeah, to Daniel's point, I think that we have reached a point in America with reality television, with the, you know, the constant news networks, where there is a melding of politics and reality and celebrity. And I think Barack Obama has become, you know, I'm a child of the 80s. He's like Michael Jackson was to us when Thriller came out. You know, it's like it's Michael Jackson combined with every other pop star of the 80s. And you just so happen to get a chance to vote for him for president.
Well, what about this? Let me throw this into the mix. You remember that Ludacris had this kind of battle rhyme song where he threw insults at Senator McCain and President Bush and said, paint the White House black, said something about Hillary, too. And the Obama campaign had to denounce the lyrics. So, you know, are there some people who are out there just kind of doing whatever they want about the senator that could actually undermine him?
Well, I think it only becomes an issue when it's someone with a big name attached to it. Like this teacher, I mean, obviously this is some, you know, this is just an individual we don't even know. He did it on his own. It became a viral video on YouTube. So it's like there's no need really for the Obama campaign to even, like, acknowledge that it exists. But when you got someone like Ludacris, where there's pictures of Barack and Ludacris together, he's praised him in the past. You know, Ludacris is a well-known figure both as a rapper and as an actor, and had his own, like, you know, Bill O'Reilly issued a fatwa against him basically, you know, a few years back and got him fired, you know, from his gig that he had with Pepsi as an endorser. So what Ludacris says is going to carry a little bit more weight than, you know, what some, you know, middle school teacher does.
Yeah, but I would also say that we have reached an interesting point with the candidacy of an African-American of president, where now we are looking at associations and who knows you and who's supporting you and who's endorsing you, and all of a sudden this has become a actual political fodder. So, yeah, you know, you say Ludacris made this song. You know, there's probably people out there. I mean, there's a song right now, if you go on the internet and you type in the Republican song, it says don't vote for a Democrat, but no one's asking John McCain to denounce that. You know, he can just kind of go along and be like, hey, you know what? People make songs about me all the time. It's whatever. But Barack Obama's got to be like, you know, I mean, Ludacris.
But who made the Don't Vote for a Democrat song? I mean, was it like Shania Twain? You know.
Who knows? I don't know who the guy is.
That's the thing is, people know who Ludacris is. I don't think people, that's the why that was a story. It was had more to do with the fact that he was such a well-known celebrity. I mean, he'd been in Crash, which had been a phenomenal movie. You know, he had a lengthy storyline on Law and Order, SVU at the time.
Yeah, he's crossed over into acting. But let me, Corey, move on to something else that you did. Corey's campaign countdown to the N-word. What the heck is that?
All right, look, this campaign is getting ugly. It's getting ridiculously ugly. It's become, with John McCain losing and dropping in the polls, he's made the concerted effort that he said he's going to go negative. And that's, you know, it's understandable. It's what you do when you're behind and you got to throw the Hail Mary. But, I mean, these people are getting, they're getting kind of close to getting into dangerous territory and dropping that N-bomb eventually. And I got a haunting suspicion that one of these rallies it's going to start with just somebody in the back yelling it out, and then people are going to get kind of emboldened by it. And while I do it in jest and say, hey, you know, it's kind of funny, I mean, John McCain's been known for his temper. He was in the Navy, and the phrase talking like a sailor or cussing like a sailor is known in the American lexicon. And I mean, if you watched the most recent debate, John McCain does not like Barack Obama. I mean, there's no love lost between the two of them.
Yeah.
So I'm just saying, I think that I don't think that it's actually, well, maybe not. I mean, maybe it's going to happen. It could. But the amount of race baiting, the amount of just animosity that's being thrown out, the vitriol that I see when I'm watching some of these rallies, it's just like, okay, clearly it's coming.
Yeah, you know, I mean, when you see the fact that where they're going with it, I mean, with the whole bring up the William Ayers, same thing all the time, basically trying to encourage this whole attitude that he's somehow involved in some sort of nefarious dealings. They never exactly say what or who they think Barack Obama is. It's like, it's an implied thing. It's like an inside joke. And they really don't do anything to tamp it down. If anything, they keep trying to ramp it up at the rallies. It's gotten more and more, you know, bigger and bigger each time. You have people shouting out terrorist, you know, and people say, when McCain would say Barack Obama's name, talking about him, you know, who is this guy? People in the audience shout terrorist. There was an incident where they're, you know, screaming invective at the media who's there to cover the event because they've demagogued the media so much. And there was a black cameraman, you know, they called him boy and shouted out a racial epithet at him. So I don't necessarily know. I don't necessarily think McCain's going to be the one to do it, but I think the rallies will, at some point, it's going to get out of control. They're being filmed all the time, and he's going to have to explain it. He's going to have to deal with it.
All right, Danielle and Corey, I just want to make sure that anyone tuning in midway is informed that this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. You are Danielle Belton and Corey Richardson, bloggers. Danielle, your blog's The Black Snob. Corey, Vexed in the City. And this is a special edition of our Bloggers Roundtable. I want to move on to some lighter fare. Tyler Perry.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we know him for wearing dresses and making money. He opened the 30-acre Tyler Perry Studios facility in Atlanta earlier this month. He's the first African-American to own and operate a major television and movie studio, but it's not all good news. Protesters with the Writers Guild of America lined the street outside, chanting, "Tyler Perry has no shame. His writers aren't unionized." And Corey, what's your, you know, perspective on this?
Well, anybody who knows me knows that I have a prejudicial opinion against Tyler Perry. Not just, I just don't like his movies. I think they're not very good.
Amen.
That's just my opinion.
Preach.
You know, now you've just given me more reason to be angry at Tyler Perry. I would protest too. If they were protesting the fact that, you know, he didn't have the proper, wasn't meeting fire code, I would be out there. I just, you know.
But what about this? What about this specific charge, which some people have said is a black producer versus black writers?
Well, I mean, I think that it's legitimate in that, you know, when you get to a certain point, it's no longer about, well, just because I'm black and you can't hate on me because I'm black. And, you know, you got to play by the rules and you got to bring other folks up with you. Now, if the rules are that you go with the screenwriters and you go with that Writers Guild, then you got to do it. Now, if you're out there and you're anti-union, you're going up against your own people, I take issue with that. Now, does it help that I don't like Tyler Perry movies? No. It makes me more prejudicial, actually. I'm sorry. I just can't bring myself to say anything nice about Tyler Perry.
So, Danielle, you also have written about Tyler Perry's movie, The Family That Prays, and said he is not good enough to be called a hack. What do you mean by that? I mean, it's pretty clear that you're not impressed, but specifically, what about that movie?
Well, the thing that I was amazed by was the no knowledge and the complete lack of concept on how to tell a story. You know, just the fundamental basics of filmmaking. You know, beginning, middle, end, climax, you know, being able to show rather than tell, you know, your work, being able to stage your actors properly and instruct them not to overact. I mean, that was one of the biggest issues. The writing was terrible. I mean, it was abysmal writing. But also, it's like he hasn't learned how to make a proper film for a film period that should be shown to anyone. Like, it's not even proper for, like, Lifetime television. It's that bad. And one of the biggest issues is he's a stage man. He's a stage actor. He's written stage plays. And in the theater realm, you have to overact to a certain extent so you can break through out to the audience. They can really, you know, get the emotions across. But if you're being filmed for television or for a movie, you have to draw it back and be more natural. This could have been a really brilliant piece of work, but, you know, it wasn't very deep. It was, you know, paper thin. A lot of the character was no character development. And, you know, I'm a movie lover, and a lot of people tried to argue with me. Well, you know, he hires our people, you know, he hires actors that you rarely would ever see. And I'm like, yeah, that's nice.
But I mean,
I'm not asking for him to make The Color Purple. I'm asking him to live up to the level of a hack, which is someone who can just, they can throw together a movie. They can do the basic fundamentals.
Okay, we have to stop you because you were on a roll with butter. and we have to get to one more set of topics, which is Tyler Perry. What about Halle Berry? Esquire named the 42-year-old actress the sexiest woman alive. And while that magazine is giving props to Halle, Vibe is paying all respect due to Eminem. Now, Vibe fans called the Detroit MC the best rapper alive and really marked him up over Jay-Z. Very controversial move. Corey, what do you think?
I think that Eminem is an excellent rapper. I'm a hip-hop fan. I think that as an artist, Eminem is great. I think that it's dubious to say that he may be the best rapper alive right now, considering the fact that he hasn't really put anything out in the past 2 years. You know, amongst his contemporaries, yes. In my top five of MCs, I will put Eminem in that top five. Is he number one? I got to hear the next Eminem album to find that one out. I mean, Jay-Z has been putting out consistent product. Nas has been putting out consistent product. Eminem is great. I mean, he's got some verses out there on some stuff. I think one of my favorite Eminem verses is on a DJ Clue CD. This song is called What the Beat, and he rides the beat. I mean, Renegade on Jay-Z's Blueprint album, he kills Jay-Z in his own song. I don't doubt that Eminem is a great rapper. I don't doubt that Eminem is a top five rapper, maybe even a top three rapper. Is he the best rapper alive? I need another album to find out.
Danielle, what do you think?
Well, I feel like that is kind of like an overstatement. I mean, he is a brilliant rapper. I think he's very talented. But, you know, I also think that, you know, compared to, like, Jay-Z, they're two very different artists. But also, I have to, you know, agree with that Eminem does not have the same body of work as Nas or as Jay-Z or, you know, even, you know, dead rappers, you know, like Tupac and Biggie, where people who've put out
They
several,
did specify alive.
I realize that, but...
Well, Danielle, let me transition you to Halle Berry. 42 years old, just had her first baby. She is named the sexiest woman alive. What do you read in the tea leaves about American aesthetics from that, if anything?
She's hot, and men of all stripes find her hot. I mean, Halle Berry is a universally hot woman. I mean, I've had my issues with her as an actress in some of the roles that she has picked, but, you know, I'm not going to argue with her hotness. It's like when people say Angelina Jolie is beautiful. She is. So, you know, that's just that, you know.
It's that simple, Corey?
We're moving into a point in America, and I know I'm getting a little deep, but we're kind of looking at beauty, and it's transcending ethnicity, and that you were talking about Angelina Jolie, or you talk about Halle Berry. You don't look at them and say, well, Halle Berry's a beautiful black woman. You just go, she's fine. You don't look at Angelina Jolie and say she's a beautiful white woman. You just go, she looks good. But there are characteristics and Halle Berry and Angelina Jolie that are not uniquely black or uniquely white. They're in some ways an exotic mix of many things, which is what makes them beautiful. Now, to say Halle Berry has been picked as the sexiest woman alive, the most beautiful woman alive, I'd like to meet the publishing or the editorial board at Esquire and give them all a high five.
It's a no-brainer. It's like saying Naomi Campbell is a hot woman. Yes.
Is this, you know, a lot of people are saying that this is a post-racial era, but is this still one where there's some kind of the black team wins because Halle wins, or are we beyond that? Danielle?
I don't think this has anything to do with race at all. This is just about the hotness.
Okay, Corey?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we're moving away from the black team and the white team. I mean, we're moving into a country where you're going to have, where there is now a different shade of brown, which is permeating our sense of aesthetic and beauty. I mean, so, you know, the days of the black team winning, I think, are gone.
Corey, Danielle, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We were talking to Corey Richardson, who spouts off at Vexed in the City. He spoke with us from NPR member station KUT in Austin. And Danielle Belton runs the blogs Black Snob and the Secret Council of American Negroes. That's our show for today, and thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tomorrow, not everyone is politically blue or red. What about green or none of the above? We take a look at third parties and independent voters. I'm Farai Chidea. This is News and Notes.